Nemoto presents American Presidents. President Gerald Ford. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 28 minutes. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project, a guided tour of the forces, intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. On an August morning in 1974, as the aftershocks of Watergate still rattled Washington, a tall, athletic man with sandy hair and a steady, almost boyish face walked up the center aisle of the House chamber. Members of Congress, many of whom had served with him for years, rose to their feet in a hesitant, weary ovation. Outside, the country was in a mood that blended exhaustion, anger, and uneasy relief. Richard Nixon had just left the White House by helicopter, the first president in American history to resign. Now, in this familiar room where he had once voted and bargained and joked in the cloakroom, Gerald Rudolph Ford Jr. was about to become president. When Chief Justice Warren Burger administered the oath, Ford did something unusual. Instead of delivering a formal inaugural address on the Capitol steps, he spoke directly, almost conversationally, to the nation from the House chamber. "Our long national nightmare is over," he declared. He reminded Americans that he had not been elected to the presidency or even the vice presidency, and he said, simply, "I am acutely aware that you have not elected me as your president by your ballots." Then he added the line that captured both his predicament and his hope. "I have not sought this enormous responsibility, but I will not shirk it." In that moment, many Americans saw Ford for what he essentially was, not a visionary or an ideologue, but a decent, straightforward man who had been dropped into the presidency almost by accident and was now trying to steady a battered system. To understand who he was and what kind of presidency he offered in the wreckage of Watergate, you have to go back to a much messier, more unsettled childhood than his later wholesome image suggested. He was born Leslie Lynch King Jr. on July 14, 1913, in Omaha, Nebraska. His biological father, Leslie Lynch King Sr., was a hot-tempered, wealthy wool merchant from a prominent Omaha family. His mother, Dorothy Gardner King, was a young woman who had married into money and discovered almost immediately that she had also married into violence. King drank, raged, and beat her. Just days after the baby's birth, the situation exploded. In one often retold family story, Dorothy grabbed her infant son and fled, leaving the house in fear for her life. She returned to her parents' home in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and began the legal process of divorce, a far less common and far more stigmatized step in 1913 than it would become later. In Grand Rapids, Dorothy remarried a few years later to Gerald Rudolph Ford, a kind, hardworking paint salesman. The boy, Leslie Jr., began to take his stepfather's name at school. Later, in his teens, he would have it legally changed to Gerald Rudolph Ford Jr., though his middle name kept the odd double F spelling from his adoptive father and dropped the PH from Rudolph. The man he thought of as his real father, the one who took him fishing, taught him to work hard, and modeled quiet integrity, was not the man whose DNA he carried. The biological father would appear only rarely, most notably when the boy was a teenager and a stranger in a nice car pulled up and announced that he was your real father. Ford's later insistence on stability, honesty, and duty makes more sense when you understand that, for him, those qualities were learned, not inherited. He had seen the damage that broken promises and violent tempers could do. Growing up in Grand Rapids, Ford lived a decidedly middle-class Midwestern life. His stepfather's income was modest, and the family watched every dollar. The Fords ran a small paint and varnish business. Young Jerry worked there, sweeping floors and hauling cans. He also worked odd jobs, dishwashing, waiting tables, to help pay for school. Church, scouts, and sports filled out his days. The family belonged to Grace Episcopal Church, and the Boy Scouts became an important proving ground. He eventually attained the rank of Eagle Scout, a distinction he was quietly proud of for the rest of his life. Sports, especially football, became his passion and his path. At South High School in Grand Rapids, he played center and linebacker, positions that rewarded toughness and unglamorous teamwork more than individual glory. He was good enough to catch the attention of college recruiters. When he arrived at the University of Michigan in the early 1930s, the country was in the grip of the Great Depression. Jobs were scarce, prospects uncertain. But on the gridiron, at least, Ford found a sure footing. At Michigan, he played on teams that won national championships in 1932 and 1933. He was not the star halfback whose name filled headlines. He was the reliable lineman, the guy who did his job snap after snap, calling signals, holding the line. His coaches valued him for his steadiness, and his teammates voted him most valuable player in his senior year. After graduation, he received offers to play professional football for the Green Bay Packers and the Detroit Lions, but pro football in the 1930s paid poorly and carried little prestige. Ford had his eye on something else, law school. He turned down the NFL and headed for Yale, where he worked as an assistant football and boxing coach while studying law. The coaching job helped pay his way. It also cemented the persona he would carry into politics, the square-jawed, athletic Midwesterner, competitive, but fundamentally modest. Law school was not easy at Yale for a student who was also coaching, and his grades were respectable rather than dazzling. But he soaked up the ways of the Eastern establishment, even as he quietly remained an outsider, the son of a paint salesman, rather than the heir of old money. By the late 1930s, as war clouds gathered over Europe, Ford completed his law degree and returned to Grand Rapids to enter practice with a local firm. He might have settled into a life of small-town respectability, law office, Rotary Club, church committees, had the world not tilted suddenly toward global conflict. After Pearl Harbor in 1941, he joined the Navy. The university athlete and assistant coach became a naval officer, serving on the light aircraft carrier USS Monterey in the Pacific. He saw action in several major operations, including the battles of the Philippine Sea and Leyte Gulf. On the Monterey, Ford's job was largely in navigation and control, but he saw danger up close. In December 1944, a typhoon slammed into the Pacific Fleet, tossing ships like toys and washing aircraft off decks. On the Monterey, fires broke out, and for a time the ship's survival was in doubt. Ford was almost washed overboard as he crossed an exposed deck in hurricane-force winds. The experience left him with a respect for the randomness of survival and the importance of calm leadership in crisis. Years later, when he had to deal with an economy in trouble and a political system reeling, he would draw metaphorically on that storm. No captain can control the weather, but he can keep his crew from panicking and his ship from capsizing. After the war, Ford returned once more to Grand Rapids. He joined a law partnership and became active in local Republican politics. His hometown was a Republican stronghold with a strong Dutch Reformed influence, and the local GOP organization was used to recycling familiar names. Ford decided to challenge an entrenched Republican congressman, Bartel Jonkman, in the 1948 primary. Jonkman was an isolationist in foreign policy and had opposed the Marshall Plan. Ford, a veteran with a broader view of America's place in the world, believed that was short-sighted. Running as a fresh-faced, energetic alternative, he knocked on doors relentlessly, spoke at every club that would have him, and emphasized both his war service and his belief in an engaged America. He won the primary, which in that district was tantamount to election. In Congress, Ford quickly carved out a reputation for diligence and personal honesty rather than ideological drama. He was a moderate Republican by the standards of the day, fiscally conservative, wary of big deficits, but supportive of NATO, the Marshall Plan, and the general architecture of post-war American leadership. He prided himself on answering constituent letters personally and thoroughly. He studied the budget like a coach poring over game film. This methodical, almost plodding style appealed to colleagues who were tired of show horses and liked workhorses. One of the most consequential early assignments of his career came in the 1960s when President Lyndon Johnson appointed him to the Warren Commission, the panel charged with investigating the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The commission's work later became the subject of endless conspiracy theories, but for Ford, it was another display of his belief in institutions and procedure. He accepted the basic conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald had acted alone and defended the commission's work for the rest of his life, even as public skepticism grew. Critics later saw this as naivete or willful blindness. Admirers saw it as loyalty to an embattled system at a moment when it was under strain. By 1965, House Republicans elected Ford as their minority leader. It was both a recognition and a challenge. The GOP had been out of power in the House since the New Deal. As minority leader, he had to hold together a caucus that ranged from staunch conservatives to moderates like himself, and he had to find ways to influence legislation despite the Democrats' numerical advantage. He opposed some of Johnson's Great Society programs as too expansive or costly, but he did not seek to dismantle Social Security or the basic welfare state. On civil rights, he voted for the landmark legislation of the 1960s. In the ideological map of the era, he was a pragmatic conservative, not a bomb thrower. Then came 1968 and the turbulence of the Nixon years. At first, Ford supported Nixon as a fellow Republican president. He admired Nixon's foreign policy achievements in opening relations with China and negotiating arms control agreements with the Soviet Union. But as the Watergate scandal unfolded, Ford found himself in a delicate position. He believed deeply in law and process, yet he also valued party unity. Publicly, he defended the administration while urging cooperation with investigators. Privately, he began to recognize how corrosive the scandal was becoming. The moment that would change his life once again came not from Watergate directly, but from another scandal, Vice President Spiro Agnew's fall. In 1973, Agnew was forced to resign after being charged with tax evasion and accepting bribes during his time as governor of Maryland. The relatively new 25th Amendment to the Constitution allowed the president to nominate a new vice president, subject to confirmation by both houses of Congress. Nixon, besieged by Watergate and in desperate need of someone who would be acceptable to Democrats and Republicans alike, turned to Gerald Ford. The choice made immediate sense in Washington. Ford was well-liked on both sides of the aisle, seen as honest, predictable, and free from personal scandal. His confirmation hearings, in a town already exhausted by Agnew and Watergate, were almost pastoral in tone. Members of Congress asked about his finances, his taxes, his views. Nothing explosive emerged. In December 1973, he was sworn in as vice president, a job that, less than a year later, would become something very different. As the Watergate investigation deepened, Ford watched the presidency unravel from the uncomfortable vantage point of the vice presidency. The special prosecutor's firing in the Saturday night massacre, the Supreme Court's order that Nixon turn over the tapes, the growing talk of impeachment, all of it created a sense of slow-motion collapse. Ford himself had not been part of the White House inner circle. He had no role in the break-in or the cover-up. But he understood that if Nixon fell, the continuity of the government would depend on him. On August 9, 1974, after the release of the smoking gun, tape made it clear that Nixon had indeed tried to obstruct the FBI's investigation. The president resigned rather than face almost certain impeachment and conviction. That same day, Gerald Ford took the oath. His first act, symbolically, was to try to restore some trust. "Our Constitution works," he said in that first speech. "Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men." For a public drowning in cynicism, it was a necessary reassurance, but trust is not restored by words alone. One of the defining decisions of his presidency came just a month later, and it would shape how he was remembered for decades: the pardon of Richard Nixon. On September 8, 1974, Ford announced, in a somber televised address, that he was granting a full, free, and absolute pardon to his predecessor for any crimes he might have committed while in office. The effect was immediate and explosive. Many Americans, already suspicious of backroom deals, saw it as proof that the powerful were above the law. Rumors spread that Ford had agreed to pardon Nixon in exchange for being made vice president, though no evidence ever substantiated that. Ford always insisted that the decision was his alone, made out of a desire to spare the country years of divisive trials and keep the presidency from becoming a permanent courtroom drama. Politically, the cost was immense. His approval ratings, which had been relatively high in the first weeks after he took office, plunged. Editorial pages that had praised him for his honesty now accused him of selling out justice. Members of Congress on both sides of the aisle felt blindsided. In the short term, the pardon probably doomed his chance at being elected in his own right. In the long term, some historians and commentators have come to see it as an act of grim statesmanship, sacrificing his own political interest for what he believed was a larger national good. At the time, though, it was a wound that never fully healed. Ford's presidency unfolded against a backdrop of deep economic trouble. The combination of inflation and stagnant growth, stagflation, was something post-war economic models had not predicted and politicians were ill-equipped to manage. Unemployment rose, prices climbed. The oil shocks of 1973 and 1970 4-cent gasoline prices soaring and triggered lines at gas stations. Ford, a fiscal conservative at heart, believed that inflation was the most urgent danger. His administration launched the somewhat naive "Whip Inflation Now" campaign, complete with wind buttons and calls for voluntary restraint in wage demands and price hikes. The effort quickly became a national joke. People quipped that "Win stood for Whip Inflation Never." The underlying problems, structural shifts in the global economy, the end of post-war industrial dominance, and demographic changes, were not something slogan campaigns could fix. Foreign policy during Ford's brief tenure was shaped heavily by Henry Kissinger, who stayed on as Secretary of State. Ford continued the policy of détente with the Soviet Union, signing the Helsinki Accords in 1975. Those accords, which recognized post-war borders in Europe and affirmed human rights principles, were controversial at the time. Critics charged that they conceded too much by seeming to legitimize Soviet control over Eastern Europe. Yet dissidents behind the Iron Curtain later used the human rights language of Helsinki as a moral lever against their regimes. Ford, not a grand strategist himself, trusted Kissinger's sense that weaving the Soviets and their satellites into a web of agreements might, over time, erode the harshest edges of the Cold War. Ford also had to preside over the visible, painful end of the Vietnam War. Although U.S. combat troops had been withdrawn under Nixon, American aid and advisors still supported the South Vietnamese government. In early 1975, North Vietnamese forces launched a final offensive. South Vietnamese defenses collapsed with stunning speed. Ford asked Congress for emergency military aid to bolster Saigon, a war-weary legislature balked. By April, North Vietnamese tanks were rolling into the city. The chaotic scenes of the final evacuation, helicopters lifting desperate Americans and some South Vietnamese from rooftops, crowds surging around the U.S. embassy, unfolded on television screens across America. For a generation, Vietnam had been a bleeding wound. Ford had not started the war, but its end came on his watch, and he had to absorb the blow to national pride. Another foreign policy crisis erupted shortly afterward when Cambodian communist forces seized the U.S. merchant ship Mayaguez. Ford authorized a rapid military rescue, including Marines landing on a nearby island and airstrikes. The operation recovered the ship and its crew, but at the cost of dozens of American lives, some killed in confused fighting, and some left behind during the withdrawal. For Ford, Mayaguez was a way of signaling that the United States, even after Vietnam and Watergate, would still defend its interests. For critics, it seemed like a too eager attempt to erase the sting of Saigon with a show of force. On the home front, Ford tried to restore normalcy and calm. He worked with a Democratic-controlled Congress on incremental policies, modest tax cuts to spur growth, adjustments to social programs, efforts to address the energy crisis through conservation and domestic production. He vetoed bills he thought too extravagant. Congress overrode many of those vetoes. The mood of the country was sour, distrustful. A president who liked to describe himself as a Ford, not a Lincoln, found that steady confidence was a hard sell in a time of trauma and anxiety. He also faced literal threats. In September 1975, within the space of a few weeks, two different women attempted to assassinate him in California. Lynette Squeaky, from A Follower of Charles Manson, pointed a gun at Ford in Sacramento but did not fire. The weapon was not chambered. 17 days later, in San Francisco, Sarah Jane Moore fired a shot at the president but missed when a bystander grabbed her arm. The near misses rattled the Secret Service and underscored how unstable public life had become. Ford continued his schedule with minimal adjustment, insisting that he would not be intimidated. As the 1976 election approached, Ford first had to survive a challenge from within his own party. Former California Governor Ronald Reagan ran against him from the right, accusing the administration of being too soft on the Soviet Union and too accepting of big government. The primary battle was fierce and went all the way to the convention. Ford, drawing on the goodwill he still had among many party regulars and using the quiet skills of persuasion honed in the House, eked out a narrow victory for the nomination. But the bruising fight left the party divided. In the general election, Ford faced Democrat Jimmy Carter, a former governor of Georgia who ran as an outsider promising honesty, humility, and a break from Washington's failures. The campaign was close. Ford, an able debater and a natural retail politician, held his own for much of it. But in one televised debate, when asked about Eastern Europe, he made a gaffe that hurt him badly. Trying to express that the United States did not accept Soviet domination as legitimate, he declared, "There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe." The statement, taken literally, sounded absurd. Of course, the Soviets dominated Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and more. Ford meant that the American government did not recognize that domination as morally or legally just, and that the spirit of those nations was not truly conquered. But the wording was terrible. His campaign spent days in damage control as commentators and comedians mocked the remark.
In a tight race, it mattered.
In November 1976, Carter narrowly defeated Ford. The man who had entered the White House without ever being on a national ticket left it after just over 2 years. His farewell address returned to themes of humility and continuity. He reminded Americans that the system had survived its greatest constitutional crisis since the Civil War and that, however imperfectly, the transfer of power remained peaceful. In retirement, Ford settled in Rancho Mirage, California, and spent part of each year in Vail, Colorado. He served on corporate boards, gave speeches, and remained active in Republican politics, though he was never fully comfortable with the party's shift toward a more ideologically rigid conservatism. He became friendly with Jimmy Carter, the man who had defeated him. The two former presidents appeared together at events, worked on election monitoring missions abroad, and modeled a kind of postpartisan esprit that stood in contrast to the bitterness of their 1976 contest. Over time, historical judgment on Ford softened and rose. The anger over the Nixon pardon never entirely vanished, but as the country moved further away from Watergate, more people began to see his decision in context. The layers of scandal, investigation, and trial that would have followed a full criminal process against Nixon might well have dominated American politics for years. Ford had chosen to cauterize the wound, even at the cost of his own political future. When he received the John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award in 2001 for that act, it was a sign that some of the very establishment voices that had once condemned him now saw something braver in what he had done. What does Gerald Ford represent in the story of the American presidency? For your listeners coming off the tragedies and triumphs of Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, he stands as a kind of pause, a man who did not seek to remake the world, but to prove that the basic machinery of constitutional government could still function after a trauma. He was not a visionary in domestic policy. He did not launch a New Deal, a Great Society, or a Reagan Revolution. He signed important environmental laws, tried to grapple with inflation, and nudged the economy through a rough transitional period. He did not always succeed, and by the standards of sweeping legacy, his record can look thin. Yet it is precisely the ordinariness of his virtues that makes him worth lingering on. He was, by all available evidence, personally honest in an era of deep distrust. He lived within his means, released his tax returns, answered questions in plain language. He knew Congress from the inside and respected it. When he stumbled on policy in debates on the steps of Air Force One, he did not blame conspiracies or lash out at invisible enemies. He simply picked himself up and tried again. His life began with a mother fleeing an abusive marriage, a new name, and a small Midwestern city where nothing was guaranteed. It took him through the locker rooms of Michigan, the pitching decks of a carrier in the Pacific, the committee rooms of the House, and finally the Oval Office at a moment when the country needed someone, anyone, who would not lie to it. He was not a Lincoln or a Franklin Roosevelt. He knew that about himself and said it aloud. But in the shadow of Watergate, a president who was just decent, steady, and conscientious turned out to be not such a small thing. For a series about the presidents, Ford is the man who proves that sometimes the work of leadership is not to launch a crusade but to lower the temperature, to keep the ship afloat in heavy seas while the crew figures out what kind of voyage it wants to undertake next. In that sense, Gerald Ford Short, often underrated presidency, occupies an important niche, the caretaker who, almost by accident, showed that the office could survive a storm and that the Constitution was more durable than the fortunes of any one man.